I'm Bill Steadman. I'm the curator at the Military Intelligence Museum at Chick Sands in Bedfordshire.
Now, we stood next to a display here which is supposed to encompass everything to do with intelligence in one display. Now, you know, you've got a tremendous museum here. You've got all different aspects. And to be honest, you need at least 3 or 4 days to go around this museum. We've got about 2 hours. But this is an attempt to encompass everything, Bill. Can you just explain what we're seeing? In the middle is the idea of strategic, operational and tactical operations or intelligence gathering, but around it there's a whole load of different ways that intelligence is gathered and used. So can you just take us through that?
What they are is explanations of what we call our capabilities. That's the toolkit of military intelligence. It's the military skills and technical backup to do various functions. Most people will have heard of Bletchley Park and the Codebreakers. Well, they are part of signals intelligence. The other component parts of that would be sweeping up communications in the first place so you can then analyse it. Traffic analysis, that's who is talking to who. And direction finding, where are these people who are talking to each other? And then code breaking, which is what Bletchley's famous for. Also on the board, we've got other skills such as reconnaissance, meteorology, which is all about collecting data, analysing it and predicting the future. Because most of what military intelligence is about is actually trying to predict the future. We've also got things like measurement and signature intelligence, which could be used, for example, to identify rockets fired from distant countries. Deception operations.
Such as North Korea, for example.
Well, absolutely. North Korea are famous for launching missiles when nobody else is expecting it. But using MASINT, people can work out what those missiles are, where they're going, their payloads, their speed, their capabilities, all sorts of technical information based on the signature that is left in the atmosphere and other ways. Plus, we've also got counterintelligence, which is hunting for spies, covert passive surveillance, that's following somebody, unlike James Bond, who is always visible in following people. But it's where
you don't need that nowadays, surely. I mean, everyone who's got a phone, they're easy to follow, aren't they?
Well, what if people haven't got a phone and know that they're easy to follow with their phone, so they're not using their phone? Or they're using one of the old Nokias, which can't be traced.
Well, maybe they've popped their phone into someone else's pocket surreptitiously.
Well, there's plenty of James Bond films to have a look at and to see how it is done and how it's not done.
I interrupted you when you were about to talk about deception, because this is, you know, where it starts to get clever. The idea is you're getting the enemy, whoever the enemy might be, to you're basically wrong-footing them.
Well, deception is part of influence operations, really, where we're trying to make people think something which isn't true or to make them forget something which is. That's part of deception and influence operations. Propaganda in old money is another way of looking at it.
Now, you've got a picture of a tank on there, but if you look more closely, you'll see that even though it's a, whatever, 25-ton tank, there's 4 people appear to be holding it up, individuals about 5-6 feet off the ground. So obviously it's a very light tank.
Extremely light tank. I wouldn't want to be in one facing enemy fire. It's made of rubber. It's one of the tools that were used as part of the deception operations around D-Day, where in the event that the Germans managed to get a reconnaissance aircraft over certain areas of Great Britain, where we were putting together a fake army, if the Germans had got an airplane there with cameras, they would have seen that it was all fake. But if you put rubber tanks and plywood aircraft all over that part of the UK, they look real to the technology of the day. So you can then mass your real forces elsewhere, knowing that you've got a good deception operation in place.
Okay, now this is supposed to be a military intelligence museum, but I see here covert methods of entry. This just looks like plain old burglary.
Yes, it's one of our lesser known skills and much lesser used. Back in the day, certainly during the Cold War, it was used on very rare occasions for the simple reason that it would be burglary if it wasn't authorised at the absolute highest levels. And nowadays, everything we do is governed by law, and you need ministerial approval. So it's something that we almost never ever do nowadays. It's much more the government agencies that get involved in that.
And also we've got here SERE, S-E-R-E, Survival, Evasion, Resistance and Escape. Now this looks like the sort of French Resistance or something like that.
Well, certainly escaping prisoners of war in the Second World War and later, if you can evade capture, that's good. If you are captured, then you need to know how to resist any form of interrogation put against you. If you get the chance to then escape, you've got to have the tools to be able to get back to your own side. Throughout that whole process, you've got to survive in order to get back home again.
But I suppose at the heart of this is in the middle here in your little board, it's intelligence capabilities, supporting decisions by military commanders, and next to it is protection. So I suppose the protection side is, am I right in saying that's counterintelligence? It's not intelligence. What you're doing is you're trying to counter the opposition.
On the protection side, you've got basic security measures that you would put in place to keep yourself, your people, your equipment, your knowledge, your secrets safe. And one of those is to stop the enemy from actually putting spies into your system. And that's one of the things that counterintelligence does. You're actively, aggressively seeking to counter the spying operations of your enemy, whether that's by arresting the spies or turning them and using them back against the other side.
Okay, so am I right in thinking MI5 is British counterintelligence? In the Second World War, what are we talking about here? Because I'm a bit confused about MI6, MI5 and different areas of, maybe army intelligence is something completely different.
Everybody seems to do intelligence in slightly different measures depending on what they're focused on at any point in history. Clearly, during the Second World War, everybody was up against it, so everybody was doing pretty much everything. As far as MI5 and 6 are concerned, well, MI5, the British Security Service, are responsible for the UK and its territories, internal security. MI6, or the Secret Intelligence Service, as it's more correctly titled, is responsible for collecting intelligence overseas. Now, that's collecting and also protecting British interests overseas.
Well, so, I was just going to say, James Bond doesn't just go collecting stuff, does he?
No.
He's a bit proactive too.
James Bond is probably the worst spy that ever existed because everybody knows who he is. But certainly, you've got this whole collection of information to give to the commanders and politicians so they can make the most informed decisions. That's one half of the equation. And the other half, as the display shows, is to protect our interests against the other side trying to do the same to us.
Now, I would like to just go and have a look in a minute at the stuff to do with Bletchley Park, because I think that's one of those, it's almost like something that we learned in the Second World War to keep one step ahead. And some people actually say that it's one of the major reasons that we won the war. And also, well, they do. They say that if you can keep one step ahead of the enemy, I mean, it's a bit like if you're in a divorce case or something. If you're one step ahead of your partner, then you do stand a chance of winning the case, you know. So let's if you could take us over to the Bletchley area.
We're at the Y Service display in the museum, which is and the Y Service were dotted around the globe wherever British forces were, listening to German and other Axis communications, and they were sweeping up all the information from the ether and doing a number of things with it. Firstly, they would do direction finding: where are the people who are talking? They would do some traffic analysis: who is it that's talking? And on some of the lower level codes, they would have a go at breaking those as well.
So were they actually also listening to open communications, or was it all coded?
There were a good number of different means of communications that the Axis were using, not only plain voice, which was rare, but a coded voice, ciphered voice through Enigma machines and things like that. So it was a whole mix of things.
So this was all over the radio, was it?
All over the radio. And other things. We've got, underneath our Enigma machine, we've got something called a Feldfernschreiber, which is actually a very early 1920s designed fax machine, so you can send noises, which reduces the number of keystrokes you need to make over sending Morse. So the Y Service
were send pictures using this,
not pictures, no.
You say a fax machine, what do you mean?
It transmits in noise. So if you were to type in, you get the normal punch cards, plus you can also transmit it as noise. So it would sound like the sort of noises you get when you inadvertently phone up a fax line.
Oh, right, okay. So sort of buzzing and beeps and things.
Oh, yes, yeah, you get all sorts of noise as opposed to clicks and taps. So the Y service would do that, and anything they couldn't decipher or decode, they would then send to Bletchley Park for them to wave their magic wand over it. Chicksands itself is in Bedfordshire, which is about 21 miles away from Bletchley Park. So, and Chicksands was one of the listening bases for the Y service during the war. So we've got that on display here. It's a common sort of statement that I've heard many, many times, that Enigma, the use of the Enigma secrets, the ultra decrypts, shortened the war by 2 years. It's a difficult thing to quantify, because by the time that we had thoroughly penetrated most of the German communications in Enigma, the war was pretty much won. The Russians were coming. They were steamrolling their way across Poland. And I dare say that what really made us invade Normandy in 1944 was the sure certain knowledge that the Russians would just keep coming regardless, even if we'd have stayed at home in the UK and not bothered with Normandy.
Well, this is to stop the Russians winning the war on their own, really.
Pretty much, because they would have done. They just would have ground the German forces down as they were doing. They were just mincemeating the whole thing up. So, shortened the war by 2 years. I think it brought forward the end of the war, certainly, because we invaded Normandy and made life even more difficult for the Germans, but it's always difficult to quantify the exact effect something like this would have had, because we couldn't use every single secret that we discovered.
Well, this is the point, isn't it? I mean, who makes the decision, and how do they make the decision? Say, if Coventry, we know Coventry's going to be bombed tonight, and if you're going to tell Coventry to get into the bunkers, because they're going to be bombed, surely that is going to also send a message to the Germans that maybe that we're listening to you and we know what you're saying to each other.
There's a chap who was MI6 top scientist during the war, really, a guy called R.V. Jones, who wrote an extremely good couple of books from the coalface.
Well, one was called Most Secret War, which was a bestseller, I think, in the 1980s.
Absolutely, and it's been followed up by The Wizard's War as well, which tells again the same stories, but with more revelations since the Enigma revelations in 1975. And that really does explain how we understood that the Germans were mounting their raids by their switching on and off of radar systems, their testing of radios. And also because the German Air Force, the Luftwaffe, used the Enigma machine, we were able to break their Enigma codes. The more you use a code, the easier it is to break. So that was the first part of Enigma that was really broken. So the Coventry raid is a good conspiracy that Churchill allowed it to be bombed in order not to leak the Enigma secret. I'm not convinced of that myself. R.V. Jones, his explanation sounds more plausible to me, that we knew that it was a Midlands city, and we had a selection of, and it just happened to be one, not the other.
But 1975 is a long time after the Second World War to talk about this. Is there really any justification, do you think, for keeping a secret like that secret for so long?
Well, with the Enigma side of things, we really were groundbreaking in the way that we were conducting the code-breaking effort. So I think that the desire and the fact that we'd mechanised it with Alan Turing's machines and other machines like the Bomb and Colossus, I think that it was entirely justifiable, because what practical use does a member of the public do with a secret like that, that one country can then listen and intercept the secret communications of a potential enemy?
But isn't it a bit of embarrassment too about some of the decisions, the playing God decisions that would have been made?
I think there's always going to be an element of that, but then leaders are elected, promoted, commanded to make and take tough decisions. And there are always going to be hindsight reviews of decisions made. And because all leaders are human beings at the end of the day, mistakes can be made. That's just the nature of certainly warfare. Mistakes are made more often than people are given credit for. We are human beings. Human beings have got a habit of cocking things up. But I think there are times for protecting secrets, absolutely, with every means you have. And those are usually surrounding a certain death to people if those secrets are revealed. So I have no problem with certain secrets being kept by all means possible.
Okay, so finally, let's have a look at, we can't really talk about intelligence, I suppose, without looking at terrorism. And the big problem we had here in Britain up until the Good Friday Agreement was over in Northern Ireland. I mean, it actually acted as actually a bit of a training ground as well for British soldiers, because even though it was right on our doorstep, wasn't it? And you've got here something which is pretty impressive. It's a propane canister, a large one, the sort of thing you might see outside a caravan, but it seems to have been converted by some Republican scallywag into a rather nasty looking bomb. Can you just tell us a little bit about this particular exhibit? Next to it is a tube. It looks very similar to the propane canister, but slightly larger. Now, just the way that that this display is presented, it looks as if that is a red propane canister mortar, a massive mortar put into a tube, and then that would be used to launch. I mean, effectively, this is a gigantic mortar bomb that they've created here using welding guns and just out of an ordinary propane cylinder.
Yeah, absolutely correct. We had some good successes in Northern Ireland in taking away terrorist smuggled in weaponry, things that you could buy not quite off the shelf, but were professionally manufactured, which then forced some of the terrorist groups to make their own weaponry. And what we've got here is, we call it the Mark 15, in that it was sort of like the 15 major version of a homemade mortar bomb. The IRA, who designed and made it, Republican terrorist grouping, used to call it the Barrack Buster, which gives you some idea of what it was intended for. And it is a propane tank with a mortar tube, homemade. You pack it full of homemade explosives, you put it down the tube with some explosives underneath it, you set the timer and you go home. And then whenever the timer sounds off, the mortar will launch. It looks very Heath Robinson. In 1985, one of these went over the fence into Newry Police Station in South Armagh, hit the canteen building using being used as a canteen. And killed 9 policemen. So it was very easy in those days for items such as this to be manufactured in the south of Ireland, smuggled across a very porous border into the north of Ireland, and used whenever. I suppose that our biggest problem there was the fact that our forensics were never very good back in those days, unlike today. So it was very difficult to prevent this sort of activity.
Now, I suppose most of us think of intelligence as being something that's done from a fairly comfortable office somewhere. But there is, on the left here, you've got a display which is, you know, you've got the camo netting over the top. So do intelligence officers actually manage to make it out into the field at all?
Absolutely. And sometimes right up close to the front lines and amongst the action as well. What we've got here is a Cold War scene, really. Based on all the information that we'd gathered about how Warsaw Pact forces, the Russians, East Germans and all those on the in the communist bloc, based on how our understanding of how they did business, tactically, their doctrine, their equipment, we would, in Western Germany, Northwest Germany, we would plot all that sort of thing on a map and then go out and war game it just to see if our understanding worked on the ground to give us some sort of lead. Had the Cold War ever turned hot, we would have needed every possible intelligence leg up that we could get.
Yeah, and I know that there was, during the Cold War, amazingly, there was this kind of exchange system where in Germany, some of the Soviet forces came into West Germany and some of the NATO forces into East Germany. What was the purpose of that? Because it seems to me as if you're playing games there, really. You know, you're saying, well, you know, we're doing is we're, I suppose, almost coat trailing, you know, here, this is what we've got, you know, here, suck this up. But it was something that was agreed by both sides, amazingly.
Yeah, in 1946, there was a Russian general called Malinin who suggested that that we form liaison missions so that the Russian liaison mission could come into West Germany and liaise with British, American and French forces who were garrisoning West Germany. And we could likewise go into East Germany to liaise with Soviet forces. a very good idea. Let's use it to make sure that we don't trip up and drift into World War III through a lack of understanding or misunderstandings. We can carry on getting all these millions of displaced people home again at the end of the war. We can carry on looking for German war criminals. But very quickly, it was used by everybody as an opportunity to have a look at what the other side were doing militarily. So, for example, the British unit was called the British Military Commander-in-Chief's Mission to the Soviet Forces in Germany, snappily titled, but thankfully abbreviated to BRICSMIS, based in Germany, in West Berlin, under the old Olympic Stadium. They would go out to liaise over the Bridge of Spies into Potsdam, into East Germany, and then they would go and have a look at what the Russians and East Germans were up to. Similarly, the Russian liaison team would come into West Germany and they would wander around having a look at what we were doing. A lot of this was very overt. Our teams were in a green painted vehicle. They wore uniform. They had flags and all the rest of it. So it was very formal and very overt. But the best people could do really was to try and be discreet about how they were collecting military intelligence information. And when the Americans and French formed their teams, they would likewise go into East Germany and have a look around. So I suppose perversely, the fact that everybody was looking at everybody else's military activity helped the Cold War stay cold, because nobody could accuse the other side of doing something they shouldn't.
Well, I think this museum is one of Bedfordshire, if not Britain's best kept secrets. It seems a shame that, you know, it's almost like you're hiding your light under a bushel here.
I think we've suffered from our own internal security measures for such a long time. We've also been on the military base for a long time, since we were first opened in 1969.
So didn't this used to be a US base, or maybe a joint US-British base or something?
It was originally, it was a family estate until 1939. And then it was gifted to the nation, and the RAF took it over as RAF Chicksands during the Second World War. It lay fallow for a few years after that, until the Americans moved in 1950 with a joint operation with GCHQ. Essentially became another listening base, and they built an enormous radio antenna on the top of the hill here, Bedford being sort of quite flat, but Chicksands being on the highest bit, was a good location to put this enormous antenna.
So you're talking about this, the elephant trap thing. That was here too, wasn't it? And I love this title because it describes exactly what this thing is. A massive circle of spikes, which, you know, actually would probably keep an elephant in.
Yeah, they were called elephant cages. There were seven of them built across the planet, one in Turkey, I think, and one in Japan and elsewhere. And really, it was capable of just monitoring communications, radio communications, from most of the globe. You could switch on any arc of the entire circle and point it in the direction you wanted to listen to. Called the FLIR-9 in technical jargon terms, but everybody used to call it the elephant cage. It became a bit of a local landmark, and local village were really upset when it was demolished in 1996.
Upset?
Well, as the story goes, when it was built in early 50s, all the local villagers were up in arms and campaigning about people ripping down our beautiful virgin forest. But in 1996, they were campaigning about people ripping down their lovely local landmark. So.
Now, I can't come and talk about intelligence without mentioning the weapons of mass destruction. I mean, this is in many, I mean, I actually would think senior officers and soldiers' minds about, you know, being fed duff intelligence, and it clearly wasn't true, was it? So have the army and have the forces actually done anything about making sure that before launching wars that the intelligence is correct?
Well, it's not actually up to the army or the forces to make those sort of decisions. In the case that you're talking about, yes, the intelligence was fundamentally flawed. The political decision to go to war was taken, and the forces then abide by their directive, and that's what the forces do. They do what they're commanded by the political forces.
But surely there's been repercussions. I mean, soldiers and the public are likely to be less confident in being told, oh, there's a reason to start a war, if things like that, you know, from the Iraq war, the dodgy dossier, as it was called, are allowed to, you know, actually start such an important conflict. You know, surely now the credibility of the intelligence is at rock bottom.
Well, the intelligence comes from many different agencies for every single requirement. You should never put all your eggs in one basket and rely on a single source or even a couple of sources. They might give you an indication, but you're always looking for corroboration. You're always looking to add more truth as far as you can ever add truth to the picture before you make a decision.
But then you could actually pass over a real diamond bit of information and say, well, it doesn't fit with the bigger picture.
Absolutely correct. You've got to really, the real skills of military intelligence are in the analytical processes, the thinking power. That's what we exist to do. But it is always up to commanders and politicians to make the decisions on what they do with the information that they're provided with. All we can do really is to give them the best possible understanding of a situation in the hope that they make the most informed decisions. Sadly, as Iraq showed, that's not always the case.
Do you think there are politicians and commanders out there that have already decided what they want to hear, that they're deaf ears to certain massive amounts of effort being put into stuff, but maybe no one will listen?
I think that's always been the case, and there are historical examples of commanders not liking what they hear and carrying on regardless. We've got General Boy Browning being provided with intelligence just before Arnhem that there was actually a German armoured unit in the immediate vicinity. He decided to ignore it. And the rest is, as they say, is history. They turned up and really did make put a bit of a spoiler on the Arnhem operation. It's always the case that you are dealing with human beings. Sometimes they have preconceived ideas, they have preconceived thoughts, they have preconceived judgments. All you can do as an intelligence officer is to provide them with the best that you can and deal with the aftermath.
Yeah, and sometimes they have hidden agendas too. Anyway, look, Bill, absolute pleasure. Can you just remind listeners whereabouts you are and how, if people want to visit the museum, they can do so?
We're at Chicksands in Bedfordshire, right in the heart of the nation, right in the middle bit. So we're long distance from everybody, but close to everybody, if you will. And the way to come and visit us is we've got a website. If you Google Military Intelligence Museum, we come up at the top because we are literally the only one of our kind. There are only three in the UK, in the entire world, I should say. So we're the only one in the UK.
So where are the other ones? You must know.
There's one in Israel and there's one in Germany.
Okay.
There's plans for one in America, but we're the nearest one for anybody in the UK. So come along.
So you have to go onto the internet and have a look. Then what?
On our website, which you'll find, there's a contact us page. On there is the email address where you need to get in touch with us. Send us a quick email with any dates that you've got in mind. We'll have a look through the diary. Because we're on the military base, we have to book everybody in through the guard room. It's a very easy process. Takes about 10 minutes. And then we escort everybody around the museum. And you get the benefit of a veteran giving you a bit of a summary on what the museum contains. So you've got the chance to ask awkward questions and you get the chance to listen to some of their war stories if that's what you wish.
Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.